What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in. This episode, I have the great pleasure of speaking with Barry Tompkins. Barry Tompkins is a 48-year network television veteran. He is a play-by-play broadcaster, a four-time Emmy Award winner, and in 2006 was voted into the International Boxing Hall of Fame for his work as a boxing commentator. He previously did the fight commentary for HBO Boxing, and he calls some of the most famous fights in boxing history, including the Aaron Pryor fight with Alexis Arguello, Mike Tyson's fight against Trevor Burbick, and Sugar Ray Leonard when he fought Marvelous Marvin Hagler to get the middleweight championship. And it was such a pleasure to speak with him. I'm a boxing fanatic, and as I say on the interview, former state champion myself. So you guys will be able to hear what it's like for me to geek out. And now I give you Barry Tompkins. Okay, I'm here with Barry Tompkins. Barry, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Pleasure to be with you, Josh.
Yeah, no, the pleasure's mine. I really appreciate it. I'm extremely excited to be talking with you. I'm a massive boxing fan. We've talked a little bit off air. I'm actually a former state champion myself. Hopefully that qualifies me somewhat to talk with you. So there's a lot I want to get into with you. But before we get there, please tell our listeners that might not be familiar with you a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Well, I've been doing what I do for a long time. I do play-by-play as much as I, you know, maybe thought of as a boxing guy. I've done football and basketball for 50 years, and I was lucky enough to be able to do a lot of other sports too, whereas like now people will think of me as a boxing guy. At one point in my career, I was a tennis guy. Mm-hmm. You know, at another point, I was a football guy. So, you know, I've had the experience and the pleasure, and I really enjoy doing a lot of different things. So while boxing is what, especially later now in my career, people know me as, you know, I've had the opportunity to do a lot of real major events, and I did the Super Bowl, and I did the Final Four, and I did the World Gymnastics Championships, and the World Track and Field Championships, and World Swimming and Diving Championships, and the Tour de France, and, you know, the Triple Crown of Horse Racing. You know, I've had a pretty broad-based experience, and I frankly have never really thought of myself as a boxing guy. I prefer to be thought of as just, you know, a guy who, you know, maybe has the ability to do more than one thing. But boxing has been a very big part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. No question. So then winding the clock back a little bit, if my notes were correct, it was in 1978, I believe, was when you joined HBO. Does that sound right?
Yeah, 79. It was kind of a fluke. My whole career has kind of been a fluke, actually. But yeah, the way it came about at HBO, actually, I had done boxing before that. I was working at NBC in 1976 when they had the radio rights to the Olympic Games in Montreal. And they were looking for somebody to do boxing. And they asked me if I'd ever done boxing. And of course, I said, yes, absolutely. You know, which has always been my theory of life, frankly. If anybody ever asked you, have you done this before? There's only one answer, you know.
Absolutely.
And then you figure it out, you know.
Yep.
And so that's really how I started doing boxing, was on radio at NBC at the Olympic Games in Montreal in 1976, and that it happened to be the best American boxing team in history. You know, it was Ray Leonard and the Spinks brothers and John Tate, and, you know, and Teofilo Stevenson was there for Cuba. And so we did a lot. I mean, all the fights were terrible, even though I was also doing track and field there. But that was my introduction to boxing, really, other than, you know, growing up with it as a kid. My dad used to take me to fights all the time. And, you know, so I had an interest in it. You know, I can't tell you I was a huge boxing fan. But when I was a kid, I was a sports junkie, you know. And so I never read a comic book. I always read a sport magazine or at that time, it was the St. Louis Sporting News, now the Sporting News. But that's what I read when I was a kid. So I've always been a sports junkie. So I, you know, I knew a little bit about boxing even prior to the time I did it. But when I agreed to do it at the Olympics, I just thought, well, you know, boxing, if you know your left hand from your right hand, you should be able to do boxing. You know, it's not like football where you got to know about 100 different people, you know. So, you know, that was That was my philosophy, and I guess it worked out okay. But I wound up at HBO also on that same kind of story, that I was doing a show actually in Moscow, and that was a story unto itself because it was the year before the 1980 Olympics in Moscow, which the Americans boycotted. We wound up not going to those Olympics. But the year before that, in 1979, the Russians had what was basically a rehearsal for the Olympic Games, and they had just called it the International Games, and they invited 100 countries, and it basically was a rehearsal for the Olympics. So there was a guy named Bob Wessler, who at that time was running CBS Sports, and he just put together this group of broadcasters, a very eclectic group of broadcasters, to do what amounted to a year earlier's version of the Olympic Games. And one of the guys that was on that crew was Marty Glickman, who in New York is an icon. You know, everybody knew Marty Glickman, and he was like Marv Albert's rabbi, mm-hmm. and a whole lot of other people, you know, rabbi meaning, you know, he was there. He taught, you know, he was their mentor. And so everybody in New York knew him, and Marty was very well known in the industry and very well respected. And Marty asked me one night over dinner, he said, you know, I've been doing some work for this little cable company, and we've been looking for somebody to do some stuff on the West Coast, and I live in San Francisco. So he said, are you interested? I said, yeah, of course. You know, I was a freelancer. I thought, well, why not, you know? And I was still working for NBC at the time. I had my NBC contract, but I moved back to San Francisco from New York. So I could kind of do whatever I wanted, as long as it didn't interfere with my NBC dates. And I said, yeah, sure. And frankly, I didn't even know what cable television was. You know, that was in its absolute infancy. And we didn't have cable television out where I am. It was a local product in New York. Anyway, it turned out to be HBO. And so I wound up doing boxing for them. That's how that started back in 1979. And the first fight I did was the National Intercollegiate Championships at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. And, you know, it was kind of an audition. I guess they liked it. And I was there for 10 years.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you, Barry. If I don't miss my mark, you started there with Larry Merchant and the great Sugar Ray Leonard, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Larry was already there when I started. Well, actually, when I started, Don Dunphy was doing their boxing.
Oh, yeah. I remember Don Dunphy. He called the fight of the century, Frazier Ali.
He called every great fight. When I was growing up, Don Dunphy was like one of my heroes. You know,
sure.
I used to lay there at night and listen to him on the radio calling these fights, you know. And so now all of a sudden I'm working next to him, you know. And you know, so for me, that was really a great experience. And Larry was already working at HBO doing it. He wasn't really a color commentator. He was more of an analyst. All the years that I was doing it, Ray and I did the fight, and then Larry did between rounds and kind of gave me the big picture perspective. And, you know, it was a pretty solid crew. I mean, Larry was a great journalist, really knew his stuff. And, you know, he's 92 years old now, living in Los Angeles, and he's still sharp as tack.
Crazy.
So, yeah.
I feel compelled to ask, what was it like working with Sugar Ray Leonard? Because he would have been in his prime at that point, if I don't... Right.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Olympics were in 1976. So this was 3 years after that. And yeah, he was, I'm not even sure he was a champion yet. He may have been, I'm not certain about that. But yeah, he was very young and very wild, you know. But, you know, we got on, I mean, he's like a little brother to me.
Aww.
And we got on really well right from the jump. And he's still a great friend of mine. You know, in fact, when Marvin Hagler died, Ray was the first person to call me, you know, and yeah, we're great. We're great friends to this day. I really enjoyed working with him. Every now and then, we still got a chance to do something together. And yeah, you know, he was not everybody's number one choice as a color analyst. And I always thought he had it in him. And I still think he has it in him. I'm not sure that anyone has ever really brought it to the fore, any producer has ever really brought it to the fore. Like, he is a real student of the game. And unfortunately, it never really came across on the air.
Huh. Fascinating. I wouldn't mind asking, if you'd rather not answer, just let me know. I'll move on. No sweat. But is there a story that you have about Sugar Ray Leonard that you haven't told before? I'd love to hear one if you got one.
You know, over the course of time, I've probably told every story that I know about him. One thing I always used to say is, you go out with Sugar Ray Leonard and you get good looking in a hurry. Yeah. He was unbelievable. I mean, you know, because he looked like Bambi, you know.
Yeah.
He had that innocent look, and he had these little hands, and, you know, he looked like anything but a fighter. And yeah, women were so attracted to him. Now, he was married at the time, so, you know, but it's mind-boggling. I mean, you go out with him, I'm telling you, it's like somebody was, Randy Cross, a football player, once said that about Joe Montana. You go out with him and you get good looking in a hurry. And it was the same thing for me with Ray Leonard. You know, I mean, people who would never look at me twice were, oh, well.
That's great. You know,
I've never seen anyone of that ilk. And I've been around, fortunate enough to be around, you know, people of that caliber in other sports. And I've never seen anyone handle this public as well as Ray. I've never seen him not sign an autograph or say, no, I'm not going to do that. Hmm. He would always sign an autograph, but he would always keep moving. And so as long as people could keep up with him, he would sign it, but he would never stop and engage. You know, with kids, he'd pat him on the head and say, how you doing, champ? You know, and that kind of thing. But he would never get in a conversation with anybody. He would sign and it'd keep moving, sign. So from wherever he was, from the ring to the car or the ring to the bathroom or whatever he was doing, he would sign. But he had it down to a science, you know, where he never blew anybody off. So people weren't insulted. And yet he got where he needed to be without getting hung up, you know.
Wow.
He's really remarkable. And even to this day, it's funny because, you know, the younger generations, their sense of history is about, and you may even be in this group, I don't know. You know, sense of history is about 10 years, max, you know. And I know that for a fact because I'll mention names of people who I worked with or whatever. I was teaching a class in college for a while, and I would mention these people, and there'd be just a sea of empty faces. Nobody, like Arthur Ashe was one of them. Nobody knew who he was, you know. But Ray, for whatever reason, maintains, people know him still. You know, you go to him, he still gets mobbed everywhere he goes to this day. And he hasn't fought for, 30 years.
Right. It's incredible.
Yeah.
I'd like to switch gears a little bit. I'm extremely keen to discuss the infamous Pryor Arguello fight. So this would be, of course, just for our audience, our non-boxing fan listeners. This would be 1982. This would be the first one. We'll get to the controversy in a minute. Obviously, but I'd love to know, what were you thinking and feeling as you were calling that particular fight? Can you recall?
Yeah, the reason I can recall is that that was the greatest fight I ever did. Not in terms of the biggest fight, it wasn't the biggest fight, but in terms of everything that went into the making of that fight. You know, Aaron Pryor was an inner city African-American guy, Arguello, and the fight was in Miami, largely Hispanic. Arguello obviously was from Nicaragua. And at that time, there was a civil war in Nicaragua. And he was a big supporter of the Contras. And so that divided South Florida, you know, in that a lot of people in South Florida hated him. So there was a real volatile atmosphere going into that fight on both parts. You know, they wanted no part of Aaron Pryor. You know, in their minds, he was a thug, you know, and they wanted no part, or there was a portion of the population that wanted no part of Alexis Arguello either. Then there was that other side that supported him unlike anybody.
Right.
So it was a really, even before a punch was thrown, it was a very volatile scene in the Orange Bowl. And it was almost a capacity crowd. I think there was about 65,000 people there. And they had decided, this is even before a punch was thrown, they had decided they weren't going to play any anthems at the beginning of the show because that could cause a problem. They had originally planned to do fireworks before the show. And they said, we're not doing fireworks because it can be a cover up for gunshots, you know. And so when we went on the air, all of that was understood. And we all knew there wasn't going to be any anthems. And there wasn't going to be any fireworks. All of a sudden, they're shooting fireworks off, you know. And the whole stadium was dark. And, you know, they darkened it to shoot the fireworks off, which nobody knew were going to be there. And there was one light in the whole stadium. And it was on me because we just went on the air. And, you know, I had a lot of business to do. I had to, you know, intro the show and bring Larry in, Ray in. And, oh, Ray wasn't there, actually, for that show, I don't believe. I think it was just Larry and I. I think Ray had a fight, so he wasn't there. So I had to do all the business of the show. In the meantime, my mind is racing, thinking there's only one light on in this whole place. They're shooting off fireworks, which means somebody could take a shot. And the only place to aim is at me, you know. And that really actually was racing through my mind as I was trying to pay attention and, you know, get us on the air and get us into the show. So that's kind of set the scene for the whole fight, you know. And of course, once the fight started, it was a brutal fight. I mean, I always say it was the best, most exciting fight I've ever done in my life. Just in terms of the punishment that was dished out was, I'd never seen anything like it. Yeah, and remember, it was 15 rounds.
Then, right.
You know, It was brutal. It was absolutely brutal on both sides and nonstop on both sides. So, yeah, whenever anybody asks me what's the greatest fight you ever did, I always refer to that fight. You know, as I said, it wasn't the biggest fight, but it was from beginning to end with all the external stuff and the fight itself. It was just an unbelievable night.
Yeah, that's incredible, Barry. Perhaps maybe just a quick note for our non-boxing fans. Boxing matches now go up to 12 rounds and no longer. They were previously 15 rounds, and that was changed somewhere in the 80s, I think.
Right.
12-round fights started to become more prevalent. The idea was supposedly fighters would be getting less damage because they'd be less tired. Their jaws wouldn't be hanging open, etc. Just a quick note for the audience.
Right, exactly. And I think the thrill in Manila was one of the galvanizing factors in that.
Yeah, absolutely. Man, the thrill in Manila. Yeah, so then obviously pressing on, you and I, of course, know about the infamous controversy about the Arguello Pryor fight. And then, so Pryor's trainer, Panama Lewis, tells his people to give him water for Pryor. And he says, points to the bottle and says, not that one, the one I mixed.
Right.
And once again, I don't mean to keep talking to non-boxing fans, but I'm just seeking to contextualize. If I'm not mistaken, only water can be given to a boxer. As someone pointed out, you can't mix water with water, right?
And
it's since been revealed that by Louis Resto, that he very likely put...
There's a good source.
Yeah. But he had said that Lewis likely put antihistamine pills into the bottle. So all that long-winded statement to say...
Why would that help him? Just clear his...
Well, supposedly it would increase his lung capacity. There was a documentary called Assault in the Ring that covered Panama Lewis and Louis Resto. You'll undoubtedly be familiar with Billy Collins and that whole thing. And Lewis trained Resto, and Resto revealed to the documentarian that Lewis had a habit of breaking up antihistamine pills. And frankly, it's the best theory I've heard thus far about what was mixed in the bottle.
I'll accept it. You know, I'll accept it. I don't, there have been all kinds of theories about it. You know, people thought it was just caffeine, you know, like a rock star. Now, I don't know. And the interesting thing about that is I didn't even hear it during the fight. I didn't hear him say that. It was only after the fight, actually, that our producers heard that and brought the sound way up, you know. But when we were on the air, we never heard it. So it only became a story actually after the fight.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know what it was. And Panama Lewis, I would put nothing by.
Dude, you're telling me. Yeah, when I found out, you know, he took the padding out of Louis Resto's gloves, that's about as low a thing as you can possibly do. As far as I'm concerned, it's conspiracy to commit murder.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah. And just one last note, it's a real shame that there was this controversy, one for all the obvious reasons, but second, because it was such an amazing fight. And it's always a shame when you have a controversy, you know, superseding the greatness of a fight.
It was. It was the best fight. It was the best fight I've ever seen, let alone broadcast, you know, from beginning to end. I mean, that one round of Hagler-Hearns was the greatest round I've ever seen. But as to the fight, it was the best fight I've ever seen. I was brutal, brutal. I mean, Arguello was never the same guy after that.
No. You know?
In fact, if I'm not mistaken, he retired one fight later after the second fight with Pryor. Yeah, it was awful. And we had some concerns because they took Arguello to the hospital after the fight. And we had some concerns about it. He really took some punishment before the fight was stopped, you know.
And Pryor was a dynamite puncher. I mean, he was a beast.
Yes. You know, and he was never the same guy either.
Right.
I mean, he had his issues. He wound up being okay, you know. It's interesting because he was doing heroin. He was begging outside the Gunn Auditorium in Cleveland for a couple of years. People used to tell me they would see him out there, and he was just a pathetic figure.
Wow.
And yeah, he got it together, got away from the drugs, got away from his environment, wound up being a trainer, moderate success, trained his son was a fighter for a while. And I saw his son not long ago, and he's doing fine. And, you know, so he didn't die an addict.
Yeah. You know? Excellent. That's always great to hear. So going forward a bit, 1985, you mentioned the war. So this was the clash between Marvelous Marvin Hagler and the great Tommy the Hitman Hearns. And this was for all the major belts, the WBA, the IBF, the WBC, and most importantly, the ring belt. I think we can probably agree that that's the standard. So as we know, it only lasted three rounds, widely considered the greatest three rounds in boxing history. I don't think that's runs risk of being an overstatement. I mean, the drama, the cut, the action were all just incredible for three rounds. Will you please, Barry, describe the event for me as you were there and what you were feeling when you're seeing this rounds?
Yeah. You know, those kinds of situations as a broadcaster, you know, you can't plan for that kind of thing. So you always hope you say the right thing, you know, a thing that makes the point without overstating it or understating it or too much hyperbole or not enough, you know. And over the course of a career, of my career, and most people who do what I do, you get, maybe I was lucky enough to get a few more of those moments, but you only get a few. You don't get too many. And you want to say the right thing. And I would say, I've always felt like if I did it right 40% of the time, you know, where I could come out of there and say, I wouldn't have changed a thing. That's a pretty big number. I think two guys that get it right more than that were Vin Scully and Al Michaels. Al almost always had exactly the right thing to say. And Vinny always had the right thing to say. I'd like to think I'd maybe fall somewhere below them. But in that, but that happened to be one round where I did, I felt like I captured the drama of the round and still let the round play. I think, you know, one of the things as a broadcaster, you know, it's television and people can see what's going on. They don't need an over description. And so that's a thin line for a broadcaster. How far do I go? You know, do I say as a left hand or right hand, a left hand or right hand of the body and a left hand? Do I do an actual play by play like that? Or do I be more generic and, you know, that's 12 unanswered punches in a row, you know, that kind of thing, you know, just kind of capsulize what's happening instead of doing it like a radio broadcast.
Right.
And quite frankly, I don't remember which one I did in that fight or how I did it, but I know I've watched it many times since. And I felt like, okay, I did that one. Okay. You know, I remember saying with about 30 seconds left in the first round, this is still the first round, you know, something to that effect.
Yep.
That kind of punctuated what it was without overstating it, you know. So that's my recollection of that round. And you can see it right from the jump, right from the opening bell. And I remember thinking after the fight that Hearns really felt he had no chance in that fight. And his only chance was to jump Hagler early and hope he can get him out of there. And, you know, you say it was the greatest three rounds. I think it was the greatest round. I think the other two rounds, frankly, they were all Marvin Hagler. You know, it was just
that's true.
When he was going to get him out of there. And even toward the end of the first round, Hearns was done. So he came there with an idea of what he was going to do, and he did it as well as he could do it, and Hagler didn't go, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, from an action point of view, I mean, those punches that were thrown by both those guys in the first round, I think would have had 80% of the fighters out there today out.
Oh, totally.
You know?
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. And like I said, you could see it right at the beginning. You could just look at Hearn's eyes even before the opening bell, and that was what he was going to do. Interestingly enough, I saw it happen one other time, too, when Michael Spinks fought Mike Tyson.
Yep.
And he went into that fight with exactly the same mindset. The difference was that he threw four or five punches, and Tyson didn't move, and that was it, you know?
Put a light heavyweight in front of a prime Tyson and see what happens.
Exactly. And there's a story that I have over there regarding that fight, too. And I had to go do a pre-fight story on both guys. And I knew Tyson really well, obviously, because I did a million of his fights. And I did a lot of his fights before he became a champion. So he trusted me, you know. But I wound up in Grossinger's up in upstate New York, where Spinks was training. And he was being trained by Eddie Futch, who is one of the great trainers of all time and just a wonderful man, master of the understood. And so I went up and we did the story and all that kind of stuff. And I'd known Eddie for my whole career. And he kind of mentored me a lot. I learned a lot from him about boxing. I would sit up at nights and just talk with him about, you know, how fights are won and how fights are lost and, you know, little things that he knows as a trainer that maybe I could get something out of. So I knew him fairly well. And after dinner, we were like sitting out on the front porch, literally in rocking chairs out on the front porch, you know. And I said to him, I said, does Michael have any chance in this fight? And Eddie being Eddie just kind of leaned back and he just went, just nodded his head. No, no. Yeah. You know, and then he went out there and he tried. And of course, we all know story that one, you know.
Yeah, my just as an aside, my dad has a great story. He said that they ordered the fight on pay-per-view and he made the mistake of opening bell going to the bathroom. He comes back you know, Tyson's celebrating. I love it. Yeah, and then just getting back to Hagler Hearns, just to I suppose kind of punctuate it, you had, as obviously you know, you called the thing. Hagler had a cut. Hearns
nasty.
Broke his hand. A very nasty cut above the eye, which for non-boxing fans, it's going to be a big deal because what it means is the blood can get into the eye and shunt your eyesight. Very disadvantageous. Sorry, I just had to nerd out there for a minute.
Yeah, no. That obviously was a big factor. I mean, if the fight was lopsided in any direction, that cut would have been enough to stop the fight.
Yeah.
It was a competitive fight, so they let it go.
But without question. It's funny that you mentioned Tyson, because that was actually going to be funnel into my next question. So feel free to go into as much detail as you like here, Barry, but obviously you called the Burbick-Tyson fight. It's going to be obviously Trevor Burbick, Mike Tyson fight for HBO. And for our audience, that's going to be November 22nd, 1986. It was for the WBA championship. One of the most amazing knockout shots I've ever seen. I've never seen one single punch, a right hook, if I don't miss my mark, culminate in three separate knockdowns. So what were you feeling leading up to it? And what was it like calling that fight?
You know, I had been with Tyson so much and I had really gotten to know him pretty well. I'll go back and tell you the backstory.
Yeah.
But I want that knockdown. I always kid about that was the only time I've ever seen a fighter have to go to a neutral corner to fall down. You know,
it's a good one.
Yeah. I mean, Tyson was, I really believed, and I don't think I was drinking the Kool-Aid. I really believed that Tyson would lose a fight for 10 years. He was that good. I always used to tell people this, but this is a fact. You know, when you were in headsets, you can hear the punches and you hear a lot of things that the television audience might not hear. And his punches sounded different. All the fights and all the fighters I've had over the years, his punches sounded different than anybody else's. And the analogy I always used were his punches sounded like dropping a watermelon off a building. I mean, it was brutal. So I really didn't think there was anybody out there could beat him. You know, and what's really interesting about Mike Tyson is, I can do 2 hours on Mike Tyson, so you'll have to contain me here. But he used to tell me all the time, he was a really thinking person. Mm-hmm. You know, and he was obviously schizophrenic is what he was. He was two different people, you know, but there was a really soft and fuzzy side about Mike Tyson. And actually, that side was there more than the other side. But he told me one time in one of those moments that he said, I'm never going to know how good I am until I lose. And he lost and he was never the same fighter.
Right.
You know, but when he was going through people, I saw him win a fight one time. It was in Atlantic City. He fought a guy named Jose Ribalta. And Jose Ribalta was a guy that was, he's a good enough fighter. He's a Cuban guy, you know, good enough to maybe fight for a championship, not good enough to win a championship by any stretch of the imagination. But if you remember, when Tyson would come into the ring and he would never take his eye off his opponent, he'd come into the ring, just wore that towel over his neck.
All black.
And he would pace like a tiger, you know. He would pace, never take his eye off his opponent, all through the introductions of the celebrities and all that kind of stuff, all through the anthem. He would never take his eye off his opponent. And I saw him win fights before a punch was ever thrown, you know. And in this particular case, I remember he did that against Jose Ribalta. And I looked across the ring, and Jose Ribalta had a look in his eye right before the opening bell, had a look in his eye like, you know, how do I get out of here? You know how there's sometimes on stages, there's a stage door that you can open
right.
And just disappear off the stage. Jose Ribalta was looking for that door, you know, before a punch was thrown. You know?
Just below the apron.
Yeah, it was just, you know, and that's what Tyson was. He would scare you. I mean, he would scare an opponent, and fighters don't usually get scared, you know. I mean, they're in there for a reason, you know.
Yeah.
But Tyson was a different cat, you know. And I did. I never thought he would lose a fight. I mean, until he got old. But the Douglas fight changed him. And he was never the same guy. He won a few fights after that, but he was never the same guy.
Yeah. He even regained the championship. What were you feeling leading up to the Burbick fight?
Well, I don't think there was any question of who's going to win the fight.
Yeah.
I don't know anybody that thought Burbick would even had a chance, frankly. I think it was just a question of
doing the thing.
Yeah. You know, how long was the question? You know, Burbick was a loose cannon, you know, more so. They always thought Tyson was a loose cannon. Burbick was much more of a, he was crazy. And which he later proved later, you know.
Right.
And he didn't have a chance. He had no chance. So I didn't go into the fight thinking, ooh, you know, this is a tough chance for Tyson. You know, I went into the fight just thinking, when, you know, you know, and it was no contest. I mean, the fight was, wasn't a fight.
Lopsided, to say the least.
Yeah. Yeah. So I, you know, I had no, quite frankly, it isn't often that you go into a fight where you're saying to yourself, I really don't know who's going to win this fight, you know? And when you do, that's what you want. You know, that's the kind of fight I want to do, where I honestly don't know who's going to win, you know, and usually you have a pretty good idea.
Right.
And every now and then, of course, you get surprised. But, you know, I'd say maybe one out of 20, you go into the fight saying, it's a pick 'em fight. I don't know who's going to win.
Yeah, I would agree for sure. So then going back to Hegler for a minute, Barry. So in 1987, you called one of my favorite fights, Marvis Marvin Hegler against Sugar Ray Leonard, obviously. And the buildup was wonderful. I mean, Leonard was coming out of retirement, if I'm not mistaken, quite a long one, actually, a few years. And people may or may not remember just how much of a monster Hegler was. I mean, right up there with Tyson in terms of ferocity. Brockton raised, right? So that should say all of it. I think there were people that didn't even want the fight to put on. They thought Ray was going to get killed. Yeah. So what were your thoughts going into that fight? And what can you recall about announcing the fight?
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Well, going into the fight, there is a story that I can tell you. Yeah, I told Ray and I were very close. Now, that said, I was also very close to Marvin. Mm. I really like Marvin. And I still think he's one of the great middleweights of all time. And I think people are judging him on that one, on that fight with Ray Leonard.
Right.
You know, which was a close fight. I think Ray won it, but it was a close fight. But I do. I think he's one of the great middleweights. You know, and I probably did his last 20 fights, maybe more than that. He was really good.
Yeah.
Really good. So here's the story. I was doing the Duran-Hagler fight with Ray. And when the fight was over, Hagler won a decision. Duran came over and stuck his head between the ropes right by where we were and said to Ray, you could beat this guy.
Really?
Yeah. And Ray, that was a turning point for Ray. You know, 6 months later, the fight was signed. About 3 months after that, maybe 4 months, I was doing a fight with Ray in Miami. And Ray said, this is typical Ray. Ray said, come to lunch with me. We're going to lunch. Okay, fine. He said, I got a boat for us and we're going to go up the Inland Waterway. You know, he said, meet me. My son is here. He's laughing, you know, because he's heard this. He's heard every story I have. But anyway, so he said, meet me at this dock, you know. So I'm looking around for, I don't know what kind of boat he rented, but it's all of a sudden this yacht pulls up to the dock. You know, it's about a 150-foot yacht, you know, and Ray's on the deck. And come on. So anyway, so that's an aside. So Ray and I were sitting up on the front deck of the boat, and we're just yakking. And Ray said to me, you want to know how to beat Marvin Hagler? Here's how you beat Marvin Hagler. And he laid out the story. He said, you got to fight three times around for 15 seconds each time. And particularly at the end of the round, you got to end the round with a 15-second flurry, and you'll win the fight. You'll steal the fight. And that was before the fight was even signed. And 6 months later, or 8 months, whatever it was, that's exactly how he won the fight.
Yeah.
So going into that fight, I thought Ray might have a chance. You know, not too many people did, but just because of that, you know, Ray, I told you, he was a real student of the game, and he wasn't only a talented fighter. He knew what he was doing in there. you know. Matter of fact, he told me one time in that fight, I want to say it was in the fifth round, I might have the round wrong. Ray told me that Hager hurt him and he almost dropped. And he said, the natural instinct is to take a step back. And he said, instead, something in his mind said, step forward and throw a punch. And so he stepped forward and he threw a couple punches. And then he got out of there and he said, Marvin never knew he hurt him. You know, and that's the kind of fighter that Ray was. He was a student of the game. Like I said, he was a really savvy fighter. And so, you know, I went into the fight thinking it was a pickup fight, even though the odds didn't say that. But based on what Ray had told me. And then after the first few rounds, when he did that, I thought, absolutely. Now, all of that said, I don't think Marvin got very good advice in his corner. You know, and I liked the Petronellis. I thought those were the people that were with Marvin. And I liked them very much. Nice, really nice people. Salt of the earth, Boston, or they weren't Boston, but Brockton people.
Yeah.
And really loved Marvin. But I don't think they were really savvy in terms of a game plan. And sure. I think they gave Marvin some bad advice.
I would agree. Yeah. I mean, as far as what Ray did, I mean, as obviously you'll know, he mandated that the rounds are 12. That's going to be a 12 round fight, not a 15. And yeah, the flurry stole it for him. I mean, I would say, because I've watched the fight many, many times. And every time I see it, it's always close but clear to me. I think
I agree.
I think Ray Leonard's ring generalship was absolutely a plus. Just his general movement, staying off the ropes, fighting off the ropes, and those 30-second flurries, it just worked like a charm. It's one of the most brilliant boxing strategies I've ever seen.
Right. You know what Ray understood? Was Ray understood the judges. You know, I mean, boxing judging is just, you know, there's a handful of really good judges, and there's a handful of really bad judges, and all the rest of them kind of come in between there someplace, you know. And I think that's what he was gambling on. You know, he was gambling on the judges. You know, they look at flurries, especially at the end of the round. And, you know, all he needs is one round or two rounds to change. It's not like he needs the judges to think he won every round. He only needs them to think that he won a couple of close rounds. And I think that's what he gambled on. And I think he stole the fight, but legitimately stole the fight. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I think I could make a case for Marvin winning that fight and all the people. I still get asked about that fight to this day, who won the fight. And I've never wavered. I think Hagler did not do enough to win the fight.
Right.
And I think Ray stole it. But, you know, unfortunately, I think of the two, Ray was the more savvy fighter.
Yeah.
You know, as much as I love Marvin, and I do, I thought the world of Marvin.
Well, right. And also, you know, it's kind of interesting. I always love pointing this out. It would probably surprise people to learn that the only two title defenses Hagler had where he had to go the distance, Leonard and Duran, were the only two fights in which he was forced to be the aggressor. He didn't really dance as such, but he played a backwards game oftentimes, and it almost always worked for him, from Mugabe to Hearns, you know, etc. So right there, you give Leonard a pretty vast stylistic advantage.
Right, exactly.
For that sport.
Yeah, and Ray, you know, Ray confused him enough that he couldn't fight the way he normally fights. And then going left-handed, that's what the Petronellis wanted him to do. Probably did it more than he should have done it. Might have won the fight being more the other way.
Right. I agree with that. So you told a great story to another interviewer about calling the Jerry Cooney-Ken Norton fight and having to drag it out because Cooney knocked Norton out so quickly. I'd love for you to relay that to your audience, Barry.
Yeah. Well, you know, that was somebody once said, have you ever seen sweat beads on the tops of your hands where you don't have sweat glands? You know, and that was the case then. It's a story. It's hard to paraphrase, so I'll kind of tell you the whole story. So,
So
it wasn't just that fight lasted a minute and 30 seconds. At that time, we had to do at HBO. We had to do a 2.5 hour show because they didn't have programming they could just stick in there. So we had to fill the whole 2.5 hours. Now, at Showtime, and even when HBO was still doing boxing, when the fight's over, you get out. They'll throw something in there, you know. But it wasn't the case back then. So we had to do 2.5 hours. So, and there were, we had four fights, including the main event. And in 2.5 hours, four fights, you know, because you got a couple four-rounders and then, you know, maybe an 8 and maybe a 10. I don't remember what it was on that night. But it's a lot of time to fill. And so they hold the first fight. They want to get the audience into it. So we always try to get the first fight on fairly quickly. So first fight comes on. We're about 10 minutes into the show. First fight comes on. Fight lasts a minute. Over. Show every replay, you know. the whole fight. Whole fight's a minute, so you can't do too much in 3 minutes. So now we have tap dance. We promo the main event, and boy, this is going to be great, and all that kind of stuff. We tap dance as much as we can for about 10 or 15 minutes. And now it's about 10 minutes to the hour, maybe 5 minutes to the hour. And we put the second fight on, you know, minute, 10 seconds. Show all the highlights, the whole fight, you know, interview the fighter. Now, there's only Larry and me on that fight. That's the other thing. Ray was at a fight, so he wasn't there. It was just me and Larry. Do all that, show the replays, promo the main event. Coming up, boy, it's the heavyweight championship of the world. Yama, yama, yama. You know, in fact, I don't even think it was a championship fight now that I think about it. But all right, so now, anyway, now we're 15 past the hour, maybe, and they put the third fight on. And now I got to just to make a long story short.
Sure.
That fight goes a minute and 10 seconds. And we finally have to put the fourth fight on because we don't want to start the main event until at the earliest, the top of the hour, you know. So, and then we still have an hour and a half, you know. So, anyway. All our fights are done by the top of the hour. We have nothing else except the main event. So we do a long lead up to the main event. Now it's the top of the hour. We do a long lead up to the main event as long as we can. We extend the ring walks, you know, so we can talk more, you know, before the first bell. Anyway, we stretch it as long as we can. Now you got first bell. Well, okay, you know the story of that fight. Lasted a minute and 35 seconds. And now it's like 10 minutes after the hour. You know, and we got to go for another hour and 20 minutes. And so Norton gets hurt, if you remember. It was really, you know, he got
badly
in the corner and hands wrapped on the ropes. And that's how Benny Kid Perrette died, you know.
Yep.
And so they're really concerned. Everybody's really concerned because they take Norton right out of from the ring into an ambulance. And my producer says to Larry, go with them. So Larry goes. Larry goes with the ambulance, you know, and they're going to do something from the hospital. So that leaves me. So now we talk to the referee, first of all, you know, and stop the fight, stop, you know, all that kind of thing, because he was hurt. We talked to Cooney, obviously, and Cooney was a very nice guy. And, you know, he felt terrible that Norton was hurt. Talk to him as long as you can, but how much can you milk an interview of a fight that lasted a minute and 30 seconds? And the guy got hurt, and the guy that hurt him feels terrible. Anyway, we did that. Show all the replays. Show them a million different times. And now it's at Madison Square Garden. And we've interviewed everybody. We've shown all the replays we can show. We've talked about the heavyweight division. You know, it just did everything we could do. And now I'm standing by myself. There's a light on. And I can see the lights in the garden are being turned off. There's nobody there. There's no more fights. Everybody's gone. There's not even a newspaper guy I can talk to because they're all on deadline. So, you know, they're writing their story. There was nobody in Madison Square Garden except my cameraman and me and a stage man. And so I'm talking about the heavyweight division. And, well, there's this guy and that guy and, you know, blathering. You know, I got no notes. I got nothing, you know. And my producer was a really good friend of mine. Says in my ear, actually it was the director, says in my ear, 48 minutes to off. And I've already used everything I got. You know, I'm down to reading my driver's license. And, you know, those situations, somehow you just do it. You just talk. You tell the same story 18 times. You just change things around a little bit, you know. And somehow we got off the air. But it was 48 minutes of ad lib. And the kicker of that whole story is I've always been lucky enough to get pretty good ink from the television reviewers, you know. But there was one guy who wrote for USA Today, Rudy Marsky, who owned me. He hated me. And every chance he had, he would take a shot at me. Every chance. So that show, we get off the air, 48 minutes. Everybody, you know, I'm getting a lot of huzzas from everybody just filling the time, you know, and not
sure. Form.
And the next day, Rudy Marsky rips me for using a cliche in that 48-minute ad lib. You know, he didn't even know I was ad libbing, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and that's so typical of Rudy Marsky. I probably used more than one cliche in there, you know, because I used everything I had, you know. But that was the upshot of that. But yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I've always said over all the years of doing this, I've probably seen, you know, everything but the walls come down, you know.
Right.
And even that was touchy a couple of times, you know.
And Rudy Marsky, of course, later criticized you in a fight that you didn't call.
Yeah. That was, they finally got my comeuppance with Rudy. Because he, so he rips me. I mean, really ripped for a fight at, that Steve Albert did, you know? And I never used to respond to him. I knew Rudy, but I never responded to any of it. You know, I just thought, well, I'm just going to take the high road, you know? It bothered the hell out of me, to be honest with you. Not because that it's his job, and my business is a really subjective business. And
right.
Some people love you and some people hate you, and that's the way it is, you know? And you have to deal with that. Unfortunately, the one guy who really hated me had the biggest pen in the industry, you know? So, but anyway, after that, it gave me a chance. I called Rudy and I said, Rudy, not only didn't I watch that fight, I didn't do that fight. I had nothing to do with that fight. It wasn't an HBO fight. It was a Showtime fight. I don't want an apology. I don't want a retraction. I want you never to write my name again. And he never did.
Excellent. I love it.
Yeah.
You know, one question I've always wanted to ask a prominent sports announcer, it might be an odd one, but I'd love an answer. If you're ever nervous before a broadcast, and if you are, how do you fight your nerves? Because look, I mean, you're on the air before, you know, God knows how many people, right? You even just gleaned at it in your last answer. You mess up, trip up one word, and you can get filleted. And I'm sure it's 10 times worse nowadays with social media and how everyone can be a sports announcer and everyone can be a critic, right?
Right.
So I'm just curious how you fought, if you were ever nervous before a broadcast, and how you fought it if you were.
You know, it's funny. I don't ever remember being nervous. Even going back the very first night that I was on the air in local television. And I didn't know, at that time, honest to God, I didn't know which end of a camera you looked through. I'd never even been inside a television station. And the anchor man, you know, said to me, and it was in San Francisco, fifth biggest market in the country. And the anchor man said to me, he said, Barry, you got nothing to worry about. It's just you and me and 500,000 people. And even then, I wasn't, that night I probably was nervous, but I didn't feel it. But I think I did a 3-minute sportscast in about 2 minutes, you know, I mean, that's read so fast.
Sure.
But no, you know, my whole job is all about preparation, and that's where the work is. And the easiest thing I do is go on here and do the show. And so I can honestly say I've never gone into a show not prepared. And so I think for that reason, you know, obviously things happen. I have all my notes blow out the window in the first quarter of a football game, you know, including my spotting. Nobody, it was raining like hell. It was in Pullman, Washington. I had nothing, you know, except the lineup card, you know. And, you know, so things like that have happened, you know. But no, you know, not really. Especially the game itself, whatever it happens to be, if it's a fight, if it's any sport, whatever, the action itself, it's all just out in front of you. You just kind of, there's no time to be nervous, you know. So the only time you might be a little nervous is in the open. Or an on-camera in the middle of the show or something, you know. And in the open, there's always a lot of business. So, yeah, it's always in the back of your mind of what order things come in. You know, you can't lead to a roll-in of something too early because the producer and director don't have it queued up. And, you know, so you can get them in trouble. And so in that regard, I wouldn't call it nervousness, but it's just...
an awareness, perhaps.
You want to get through it. You want to get through the open. Once you're through the open, it's like downhill, you know, as long as you're prepared. But like I said, that the bottom line of this whole thing is preparation. That's where all the work is prior to the time the light goes on.
There's a brilliant life philosophy in there too, if you don't mind me saying. Excellent. I'm curious, can you recall, I just have a few questions left, by the way, Barry, if that's okay.
That's all right.
I appreciate it. I'm curious if you can recall what your best or most memorable moment as a commentator was.
I've really been lucky enough to do a lot of major events, and it's always, if you know that you did it right, it's always a really good feeling when you get off the air. I'm trying to think of one or two. You know, obviously, Leonard Hagler, I thought I did as good a job as I know how to do. And again, you put it out there, and it's a love-hate thing for your audience, you know. But generally speaking, when I get off the air, I know if it was a good show or a bad show. I don't need Joe Sixpack to tell me how good it was or how much I sucked. I usually know. And I would say maybe there's 10% of the games or events or whatever you do, where you get off the air and say, I wouldn't have done anything different. You know, 90% or say 80%, you get off the air and you kind of say, you know, I wish I would have done this a little bit differently, you know. And then there's 10% where you just say, that stunk, you know.
Right.
Either because it was a lousy game or you did a lousy broadcast. You know, and those happen. And quite frankly, you get as many, that was a great show, from a lousy broadcast as you do from shows that you think are great, because it's that subjective thing again. I love it, I hate it, you know.
Yeah.
But as a professional, generally speaking, I know if it was good or bad. And the good ones separate themselves, you know. They always come in. I mean, if I'm doing a Cal Poly UC Davis basketball game and I don't do it perfectly, I mean, I screw up something, you know, I'm not going to worry about it as much as if I'm doing the final of the French Open.
Right, right.
I've had at the French Open, actually, Ivan Lendl was playing Michael Chang and Chang had cramps and Lendl was about to win the match. It was a semifinal match. The winner went to the final and Chang served underhand to him and it surprised him so much he aced him. And Chang went on to win the match because Lendl had him and Chang was doubled over in pain. He just flipped an underhand serve and aced him and wound up winning that game and won the match. And so, you know, that was a real high moment. And sometimes the high moments are where you just shut up. You know, I mean, that's, you want to let the crowd tell the story of the game as much. And when I say game, I mean, it could be a fight or whatever it is. But
sure,
the crowd is an important part of it. You know, so like when Tyson knocked Burbick out, I let the crowd play and then came back and kind of capsulized it, you know. And those, to me, those are things that maybe set a broadcaster apart. I mean, I think the really good broadcasters do that. There's a different philosophy about broadcasting now, quite frankly, than it was when I started. I was told the game is what's important, not you. And I've lived by that philosophy. I want people to remember the Leonard Hagler fight, not Barry Tompkins. You know,
right.
That doesn't matter to me. You know, my mentor in this business told me, your job is like the referee. If you do it right, nobody notices you,
mm-hmm.
You know? And so that's always been my philosophy. You know? So get out of the way. Hope you say the right things in the right moments. Don't overstate it. And then go have dinner.
Buy yourself a drink to celebrate.
Yeah.
No, thank you, Barry. Wonderful. In 1988, you were replaced with the great Jim Lampley, who would go on to call fights until HBO Boxing wrapped, as a matter of fact. I would love to know, Barry, how that transition took place from your side.
Well, I mean, to be really honest with you, you know, this is a fickle business. And everybody in the business at one time or another has been fired. No, I didn't get fired from HBO. But what happened was I was in the last year of my contract. And ESPN had been knocking on my door for a long time. And I've always been one, I think I mentioned to you, I like boxing,
mm-hmm.
but I like doing a lot of different things. And I always found that's what keeps me fresh. I don't want to get stale doing one thing. And my contract with HBO was pretty limiting in the sense that I could not work for another cable network. Now, I did football while I was at HBO, but it was for syndication. Or I think for a time I did Stanford football, and then I went up to the University of Washington football for a while. And basketball at that time was largely syndicated, so I could do basketball too. So I always did football, basketball, and then I did boxing for HBO. And I did Wimbledon for HBO. And I did some gymnastics at the time, and I did that. I did the World Figure Skating Championships. And they didn't do a lot of that, but they did some. So I did all of that. ESPN had been knocking on my door for two previous contracts. And, you know, and frankly, I was making a lot of money at HBO, and for the time, not by today's standards, but for the time. And I got treated pretty good. I mean, they treated the people really well. And it was growing like topsy, you know. So they had more money than they knew what to do with. So it was really riding on a gravy train for a long time. And then it got a little old for me. And as I told you, Rudy Martsky owned me and he'd rip me every show. And Seth Abraham, who was running HBO at the time, he read the newspapers and he cared what Rudy Martsky said. Nobody in the industry did, but Seth did because he was a big ego and he felt it affected him, you know. So my relationship with Seth was deteriorating. And really it was Seth that had known Jim for a long time. Jim and I have been friends for a long time and remain friends. And I will say this, he replaced me at HBO and he held me in high esteem publicly and privately. ever since then, you know, and I have no bone of contention with, I don't feel like he took my job or anything like that. He's a class act. He always will be. And he's a real pro.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to sit here and say I did boxing any better than he did, you know, or right. any others. He's a pro, you know, and in my business, the pros know the pros. But anyway, so Seth and Ross Greenberg was the executive producer and is still a friend. They were in San Francisco and they asked to have dinner. And so we were at dinner and we just started talking about one thing and another. And I guess I've always had a big mouth. And I just said, you know, look, you know, you're reading Rudy Marsky and I know it affects you and it bothers you. And, you know, I've been talking to ESPN. And so I said, why don't you just buy me out of my contract and hire Jim? You know? Hmm. And Seth said, oh, let me think about that. And that night I went back home and he called me and said, okay, we'll do that. You know?
Wow.
And, you know, and I'm thinking, what the hell did I just do? You know, because I had no deal with ESPN. You know, we'd been talking, yeah. I had no deal with them. Yeah, so that's what happened. You know, and Jim took it over. And I can honestly tell you, other than a few of the people there who I really liked, I didn't miss it for a minute. It had gotten to be no fun. So, you know, yeah, I wouldn't lie to you. I missed the paycheck because my ESPN deal was not nearly as much as the HBO deal. But I got to do what I wanted to do.
Sure.
And that was a big thing for me. So everybody was happy. HBO was happy. They got Jim. Jim was great. Jim was with them for whatever it was, 20 years, I think.
Long time, yeah.
I wound up making a lot of money there because the rates really skyrocketed after I left. I was at ESPN for 9 years, and I did boxing with Al Bernstein.
Yep.
That was every Tuesday night, but it didn't interfere with anything else, and I did.
The great Al Bernstein.
Yes. I was still one of my best friends.
Oh.
And we still get to work together every now and then at Showtime. And yeah, so I did boxing with Al, and I did basketball. I didn't do football for them. Still did football out on the West Coast. But I did, you know, I became their tennis guy. So I did, whereas I was doing Wimbledon at HBO, I did the French Open and the US Open for ESPN. And they would put me on I did the World Track and Field Championships, Swimming and Diving Championships, Figure Skating Championships. You know, I did the Tour de France. And, you know, they put me on things, on all those kinds of things, because I told them I really like that. And I did. And so I had a great time. I had a great time at ESPN. And then I left. I was there for 9 years, and that was when Fox Sports was just starting. In 1995, and my son was born in 1990, and I have two kids from previous marriage. And I was on the road. I made my last year at ESPN, I made 40 coast-to-coast trips.
Wow.
And I said to myself, you know, that I missed my first kids growing up, you know, and now I got to take two here, and I'm not going to miss this kid growing up, you know. And so I went to Fox because I could do the Pac-12. They wanted me to do the Pac-12 and boxing, you know. So almost everything was on the West Coast. Well, my boxing wasn't, but everything else was on the West. Almost everything else was on the West Coast. So my travel days, I probably traveled 50 days a year less with Fox than I did with ESPN. And I did get to see my son grow up.
Wonderful. You can't beat that.
No. Now he's growing up. He's a foot taller than I am. And, you know, to beat me up. You know?
This will be the last question, Barry. You've been very generous with your time. I appreciate it. Thanks, Barry. I simply have to discuss Rocky IV. There's just no way around it. It just has to happen. It was.
So, you heard me tell this story.
So just to cue it up, it was in 1985. You played, actually, I think it was a USA Network broadcaster calling the Balboa Drago fight.
HBO was not very happy about that, incidentally.
Is that right?
Yes.
So just to funnel it out or flesh it out, how did the opportunity come about and what was it like filming? And yeah, I'd love to know what HBO's gripe was.
Well, I'll start with that. Their gripe was I was promoting another cable network.
Prominent.
You know, that's the way it is. So it came about on a fluke like the rest of my life, you know. And it was actually, I had like 3 weeks without a show, which was really rare in those days. And I got a call from this agent, and it wasn't my agent. It was a friend of mine's agent, Steve Fiziak. I don't know if you know Steve. He does the Kansas City Royals. But anyway, it was his agent, and Steve was a friend of mine. And I think they asked Steve to do it, and he couldn't do it. And so Steve told her, why don't you call Barry Tompkins? He does boxing, you know? So she calls me, and it happened that I had a hole in my schedule. It took 2 weeks to do that scene. And I thought, well, you know, I'm so used to live television, you know, where the red light goes on and you talk and the red light goes off and you say goodnight, you know, and then you go home, you know. So I'd never done a movie kind of thing. I'd done some voice tracks, you know, and things, but never an actual scene in a movie, you know. Sure. So I thought, well, it'll be something different, you know. So I said, okay. And they paid me $2,500 for 2 weeks, you know. I'm thinking to myself, you know, I could probably tote newspapers and make $2,500 in 2 weeks, you know.
Right.
So anyway, so I went and did it. And it was, I hated it from like the second day because it wasn't television. It wasn't, you know, where the red light goes on and you talk and the red light goes off and you say goodnight. This was one scene and it was, I want to say a 12-minute scene. And it took 2 weeks to film.
Wow.
You know, and it was supposed to be winter in Moscow. And it was summer in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Oh.
And so you had to dress like Nanuka the North, you know, because you were supposedly in this cold climate, you know, and it was 150 degrees in there, you know. And because we were the broadcasters, we're in the first row, so we're in every shot.
Right.
So you couldn't read a magazine or do a crossword puzzle or anything. You had to sit there and look like you were interested, you know. And that went on for like 8 hours a day, you know, for 2 weeks. And the audio part of it literally took one day, not even a full day, because we did it in two takes, you right. know. And so I wound up, I have to say, I had great respect for Sylvester Stallone, because he's a guy, you know, he plays the dumb guy, you know. But he knew what, you know, it was 15 cameras, and they choreographed those scenes. It's like a dance. I mean, it really is, almost to the extent that there's footsteps on the mat, you know, that you follow the footsteps, you know.
Huh.
And they have 15 cameras. And they'd roll a scene and they'd, you know, they would do the boxing scene. It would probably be like a 30-second take. And Stallone, at the end of the take, would say, okay, camera 14. He'd go look at the rushes. And then he'd come back and say, oh, camera 14, I want you to move 1 foot to your left. Camera 6, you're a little too low on that shot. I want you to come. And wow. He was really on top of it. You know, so it was all that. The story I always tell, it made me realize how much I came out of there with not a high regard for actors. Quite honestly, you know, because I'm so used to, you get one take, you don't get more than one take, you know.
Right.
But there were a few of them that I really came away respecting a lot. And one of them was the guy that played the part of Drago's manager, if you remember the scene. So there's one scene, which you probably will remember, was when Drago started to lose and Rocky started to come on. And it was between rounds and the manager comes up and runs up out of the crowd, out of the ring apron, and says to him in Russian, it's all in Russian, it's about 30 seconds long, you know, you're screwing up, come on, you're embarrassing your country. I don't know what it was, but it was in Russian. And Stallone's wife, who was played by his girlfriend, Bridget Nielsen, she was in the audience, and the scene ended with her standing up and saying, "Niet." That was her line, "Niet," no, in Russian, you know. But she had to be concerned, you know. So the actor who played the part of the manager, who did not speak Russian, but had this 30-second diatribe in Russian, roll of cameras, he runs up, comes up on the ring apron, does his 30 seconds in Russian perfectly. She stands up, says, "Niet," cut, you know. Stallone says, give me concern. Take two, roll of cameras again. He comes up, runs out of the audience, 30 seconds in Russian, perfect. She stands up, "Niet." Cut, take three. He gave her every emotion known to man. You know, give me anger, give me hate, give me love, give me desire, give me, you know, give me need. I mean, you think of an adjective, that's what, you know. So 32 takes later.
Wow.
32 takes. He does his part in Russian perfect every time. And she kicks "Niet" 32 times. And finally, he says, "We'll loop it," you know, which means they'll have somebody else do it in post-production. You know?
Jeez.
That's what that business was like. And the guy that did the Russian part was unbelievable. You know, and he's a character actor. You've seen him a million times. Not a star, but a guy you've seen a million times. And I'm sure he gets hired because he's that good.
Wow.
But that was the thing. Everything was 25 takes, 15 takes. We did our part too, you know?
Right.
But again, he was consistent because what he said to me, there was a script, and I said, "Do you just want me to follow the script?" And he said, "No, you could do, you know, as long as you follow the outline, you can do whatever you want. He said, what I want you to do is I want you to do what you always do, but I want you to exaggerate by 15%. Go 15% over the top, you know, which is exactly what I did. Just got crazy, you know, a bunch of stuff. And he said, can it, you know, done, you know.
Fascinating.
And yeah, you know, and then, and of course, the upshot of the whole thing was like, I came home grumbling, you know, 2 weeks, $2,500, you know, this really sucks. You know, I hate it. I'm never doing another movie. I don't know how these people do this, you know. And, but then it turned out the way they edited the movie, I was on camera for so many seconds. I don't know what it is, but there's a union thing that if you're on camera for more than, I think it's 30 seconds, you become a principal in the movie, which means you get residuals.
Ah.
And I'm still getting residuals from that movie. So it was $2,500. And over the course of time, I don't even want to tell you how much those checks have been, but it's stupid. You know, I'm still getting, last year I probably made $4,000 off that movie.
Wow.
You know, and that's 30 years ago. You know?
Not a bad decision, all things considered.
No, as it turned out, quite good.
Gosh, I really could sit here all day and talk with you, but I think out of respect for you, Barry, I think I'll end with a question. Barry Tompkins, how can people find out about you, sir?
How can people find out about me?
Or do you want them to leave you alone?
No. I don't mind. But, you know, I mean, I have a Twitter handle and I use it, but I don't post very much. I might respond to people, but it's Barry_Tompkins. And I have a website, but I don't keep it up. Other than giving you my phone number up, which I'm not going to do. You have it, but, you know, on either on Facebook or Twitter, I'll always respond if there's a question or if you want to know something or anything like that. You know, those kinds of things I'll respond to. I just, you know, it goes back to what I told you before about I don't consider myself more important than the event, that I'm not going to do a lot of pontificating on Twitter, you know, because, and to be brutally honest with you, you know, I don't really care what Joe Sixpack thinks, you know. I really don't. I don't care what a boxing fan thinks about who's better than who. You know what I mean? I'm not a fan. You know, I mean, that may sound arrogant, you know, on my part, but
no, I get it. That's
my job. You know, it's my job to know those things. Generally speaking, if I'm not doing a sports event, I won't watch, you know, I try to watch boxing when I can, but it's not because I do a lot of these kinds of shows and things. And so I feel like I have to know about fights other than the ones that I do.
Right.
You know, so I do that, or at least I'll try to watch them on video, you know, after. But no, I'm, you know, the irony of my whole business is you get into it because you're a big sports fan. And I was huge. And then once you start working for a network, you have to stop being a fan just by its nature. I can't do a game or a fight or anything if I have a rooting interest in one or the other participants winning. You know, I can't, because there's going to be a bias that shows up, you know, somewhere. And so I really don't care. You know, I haven't done a game of any sort where I've cared who's won probably in 30 years, you know.
Yeah.
And to the point that if I don't write the score of the game down and we have a 10-minute fill at the end of the game, I won't remember the score of the game. And half the time, I won't even remember who wins. So I have to write it down at the end of the game, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah, there's just a big difference between being a fan and being a professional, you know. I can't care, you know.
Right. Very interesting. It makes perfect sense. Well, Barry Tompkins, this was such a pleasure, sir. Thank you so much for taking the time for me. This was great. I'm so Absolutely. Happy to spoke with you.
Anytime at all. No problem.
Awesome.
All right. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you, Barry. It. Yes, sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.